Hello, I'm Bruce Selry. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Don't quit your day job is how the saying goes. But does that mean you have to give up something that you're passionate about in service of your full-time job? A lot of people nowadays are taking up these side gigs, these side hustles, as both a secondary source of income and also a passion project. I'll speak with Will Reyes, someone who's got a side hustle in photography. She also has a day job at a software company called Humi. She's going to be here with her CEO, Kevin Kleiman. He's a big supporter of side hustles, and we'll find out why. You want to run your own show, but you aren't sure you want to start something from scratch? What about entrepreneurship through acquisition, ETA? Scott Sturrett is founder and CEO of Venture for Canada. He says entrepreneurs should look at acquiring existing businesses as an option. He's going to talk more about that. And if you've got a lot of debt, there are options out there for you to consider. One of them is bankruptcy. One of them is a consumer proposal. Another is a debt consolidation program. Today, we're going to focus on the first two. Shelley Coley is a licensed insolvency trustee at Harrison Partners, and she's going to talk about those options and how they work. Plus, I'll speak with Michelle Hilscher, behavioral scientist at BE Works, about her company's course for financial advisors. Really great training opportunity to help improve relationships with clients. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. When I think of entrepreneurship, I think of these like iconic stories of Mark Zuckerberg founding Facebook in his dorm room and Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis founding BlackBerry using parts from video games they got at Radio Shack. These entrepreneurs really start from nothing. But there is another way. You actually can start from something. It is called entrepreneurship through acquisition. Scott Sturrett is the founder and CEO of Venture for Canada. It is a national charity with a mission to foster the entrepreneurial skills and mindsets of young Canadians. And he joins us now to talk about it. Hello there, Scott.
Hey, Bruce. How are you doing?
I am well. So full disclosure, I sit on the board of VFC. I know you. I know the world in which you work. But I'm fascinated by this topic. Tell us more about what you mean when you use the phrase entrepreneurship through acquisition.
Entrepreneurship through acquisition is essentially entrepreneurial behavior where rather than starting something from scratch, you buy an existing company. So that could be everything from buying like a local laundromat to buying a company much larger.
And how common is this?
Entrepreneurship through acquisition is something that's existed for a long time, but in many ways, the trend is accelerating as we have this massive silver tsunami of aging entrepreneurs who need to sell their existing companies. So entrepreneurship through acquisition is something that is increasingly prevalent in Canada, Bruce.
I think about this, and where I see it is financial advisors basically selling their book of business to other people who want to get into the business or expand their business. What are some other areas or sectors of the economy in which this is most prevalent?
Some of the most prevalent sectors as it relates to entrepreneurship through acquisition are maintenance businesses. So HVAC companies are actually one of the most trendy companies to buy right now. A ton of annual recurring revenue, quite profitable enterprises. Another really popular type of company amongst a lot of entrepreneurship through acquisition folks are self-storage businesses, which in essence are kind of a real estate play, but also have really steady income that's coming in. And lastly, an increasingly common target for a lot of entrepreneurship through acquisition entrepreneurs are software as a service companies, so SaaS businesses, which you wouldn't necessarily think is something that people are buying. And you think of SaaS businesses are often as these huge firms, but a lot of ETA entrepreneurs are beginning to look at tech businesses as well as a target for acquisition. So in short, there's a lot of traditional businesses, but there's also a lot of tech-enabled, more modern businesses that are also targets of acquisition.
Some of our listeners might be like, oh, wait a sec, that's not entrepreneurship. That's just being a business owner. How would you reconcile that disconnect?
There's varying levels of entrepreneurship through acquisition. So I would argue if you buy a business and just kind of run it business as usual and don't make any changes, it's probably maybe not that entrepreneurial. But there are lots of people who buy businesses that might be relatively small and then scale them to be significantly larger. For instance, I met recently two entrepreneurs in Toronto who bought a company called Riverdale Poultry, which is in the chicken business. They bought it, had like 40 employees. They now have like over 250 employees. And one other really famous example is Constellation Software, which is, I believe, Canada's second largest tech company by market capitalization, only after Shopify. And Constellation Software is 100% basically fueled by acquisition, and it has a market capitalization of almost $60 billion.
How does one go about doing this? Is there like a, I don't know, is there like a trade show where you can, is there speed dating for people selling their businesses?
There are some events and conferences across Canada that do connect people who want to buy businesses with people who want to sell. One of the most common ways as well are through business brokers. So there's a whole industry in Canada and across the world of folks who buy and sell like businesses and who help to kind of facilitate the transactions. So brokers will sometimes do events and kind of bring together different buyers and sellers. But often the best deals, the best companies to acquire aren't for sale. So if you're an entrepreneur through acquisition, often it requires a ton of cold outreach, a ton of grit to find these great deals that are often hidden away.
How does one go about funding this? Because it would seem to me that it is cheaper to fund Facebook in your dorm room than to buy an established HVAC company with a client list and maybe leases and, you know, all those things.
The financing varies generally on the size of the deal. If you're buying a company that is, let's say, less than like $1 million, you're going to find it pretty challenging to get a lot of debt capital to finance. So generally, most of the acquisition is going to be financed at that smaller level with your own personal capital or the capital of investors, or potentially a seller financing. So in essence, the seller lending you money to like buy the business. The smaller the company, the generally more prevalent that seller financing is. As a company grows in acquisition, and there's lots of acquisitions that are in the millions of dollars where someone's buying a company, 2 million, 5 million, et cetera. What happens is the typical kind of ratio of, in terms of the financing of like a $5 million acquisition would be approximately 60% in debt financing, 20% in seller financing, and 20% in your own equity. So essentially, to buy a $5 million company, you need to come up with around $1 million in equity.
Wow. Well, coming back to your mission, fostering entrepreneurial skills and the entrepreneurial mindset, what is the same and what is different about doing that when you're talking about entrepreneurship through acquisition versus Facebook in a dorm room?
There's a quite a different profile of person who is skilled and interested at the early stage entrepreneurship of creating something from scratch than somebody who's really suited to acquire a company and then kind of grow it. So what I'd say is that in terms of that really early stage type of entrepreneurship, that kind of gritty, it's often kind of people who thrive in highly ambiguous situations who like to get their hands dirty and kind of try all aspects of entrepreneurship. And love kind of testing out new business models and the and kind of have that kind of prototyping mindset. Versus, I would say that the mindset and skills of an entrepreneurship through acquisition person tend to be more like process oriented. People who are taking something that's existing and you're optimizing it, you're making it more efficient. And it's to say there's still creativity in entrepreneurship through acquisition, but I would say that ETA entrepreneurs are perhaps a little bit more focused on the process, on systemizing, versus early stage entrepreneurs are a little bit more focused on that scrappiness and just kind of testing out a bunch of ideas.
There's risk in both paths, but the risk would seem like it manifests quite a bit differently if you're starting something from scratch. You know, you don't have a job, maybe you're mortgaging your house to pay for it. But if you've bought a business for $1 million, you've got a different risk profile. How would you have people think about it for themselves to see which might be the path that is more resonant?
I think that if you have access to capital, buying an existing company in most cases is significantly less risky than buying something from scratch. Lots of stats show that the highest likelihood of a business going bankrupt is in the first couple of years of operation. So if you're buying a business that's been around for decades, there's a pretty good likelihood that it's not going to go to business kind of anytime soon. That being said, there is absolutely still a ton of risk in being an entrepreneur through acquisition. Some of the risk can, there's two kinds of risk. One is that you spend a lot of time and money trying to buy a business and you never end up getting a good deal. And for instance, I was speaking with somebody yesterday who spent around 2 years acquiring a company full time, doing this as his like main job, and he still hasn't acquired the firm. And he spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on legal fees, accounting. So there's that risk. There's also the risk in terms of you buy a business and it's a lemon. And then all of a sudden you owe millions of dollars to the bank. That being said, the stats show that entrepreneurs through acquisition, once you actually acquire a firm, there's a pretty low likelihood that that business shuts down within the first couple of years of you acquiring it. So I would say in aggregate, entrepreneurship through acquisition is a less risky path than starting something from scratch.
One of the things that you have a real value around, I have a real value around, is underrepresented groups and enabling them, empowering them to participate as fully as possible in building a prosperous future for this country. What is, again, similar to and different from as we talk about entrepreneurship through acquisition for underrepresented groups?
Entrepreneurship through acquisition presents a phenomenal opportunity to further equalize access to wealth and capital in this country. I think that entrepreneurship through acquisition can be a huge opportunity for underrepresented entrepreneurs to create wealth for themselves, their families, and their communities. And it's a lower, as we were talking about kind of earlier, it's a lower risk path into entrepreneurship. For a lot of underrepresented entrepreneurs, it can be incredibly risky to go start something from scratch versus, for the reasons that we discussed, it's often a lot more achievable. It's a lot more accessible to acquire an existing company. So I think when it comes down to underrepresented entrepreneurs, entrepreneurship through acquisition presents a phenomenal opportunity to create wealth for themselves and for communities.
Looking out over the course of the, I don't know, 5 to 10 year time horizon for Venture for Canada, your programs are entrepreneurship, fellowship, those kinds of things. And you have a real strength in the startup community. Where will VFC play when it comes to this as a connected but somewhat distinct category of entrepreneurship?
There's two different things I think Venture for Canada can do longer term and medium term in terms of entrepreneurship through acquisition. The first is potentially launching a course that would teach Canadians the basics of entrepreneurship through acquisition. So how do you raise capital to acquire a company? How do you conduct a search? What does the first 100 days look like post-acquisition? Is entrepreneurship through acquisition right for you? What are the risks that you're taking on? So that would be the first kind of idea that Venture for Canada could do. And it would be a kind of ETA 101. The second idea, longer term, is Venture for Canada doing more structured programming to really help ETA entrepreneurs go out and buy businesses. So that could be playing a more structured role in helping these entrepreneurs acquire capital to buy these businesses, providing more structured mentorship. So essentially, it would be the more intensive version of what the ETA 101 course would be. Mm-hmm. It would be kind of ETA 102. There's a few different models in the US where organizations have successfully implemented the two kind of visions that I mentioned. But I think there's a huge opportunity in Canada for there to be way more ETA educational programming, because compared to the US, there's so much programming there and there's almost none in Canada. Hmm.
Really interesting stuff. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Scott Stewart is the founder and CEO for Venture for Canada. He joined us to talk about entrepreneurship through acquisition, which is kind of a different spin. Lots of insight there on what that means and whether it might or might not appeal to you. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, the difference between a consumer proposal and a bankruptcy filing. Two options if you've got debt you cannot manage. Shelley Coy from Harrison Partners. We'll talk about those two things. Later, we'll speak with Michelle Hilscher from BE Works about their behavioral science course for financial advisors. If you've missed an episode of Moolala, you can head on over to moolala.ca, listen to past episodes there, and you can listen to just segments by searching name or topic. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms, Amazon Prime, Apple Music, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, and download the full show, download segments, write a review, even subscribe. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. If you are dealing with a level of debt that you cannot manage, there are actually a number of options that you can look to pay it back. Now, you've heard us talk on the show about the nonprofit credit counselors and the debt consolidation program. We also talk about the services that a licensed insolvency trustee can provide, and two in particular, the consumer proposal and the bankruptcy filing. They're not the same. So today we're going to focus on what each is and what the relative pros and cons would be. Our guest is Shelley Coley. She is a licensed insolvency trustee with Harrison Partners, and she joins us from New Westminster, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. Lots and lots of people have debt. What is the line at which you would say that is a level of debt that they need to get professional advice on? It's not $1,000, but it's certainly less than $50,000. So how would you guide people to say, listen, now's the time you need to pick up the phone?
I think it varies from person to person. What is a lot of debt to you? May be different from your neighbor down the street. It all depends on their socioeconomic status. So for example, if you've got a single mom with three kids, $20,000 debt might be insurmountable to her, whereas a professional, it might be over $100,000.
Right.
So I think what I'm saying here is seek out professional advice and you'll get guided to what the best option is for you, even if that means I'm not the best option for you.
Yeah. We, as nonprofit credit counselors, we think of there being a continuum of care, and there's lots of things that people can do to get a better handle on their debt. For some, it's, I'm going to do a budgeting course. And for others, it's going to be a much more formal solution that an LIT would, a licensed insolvency trustee would provide. Consumer proposal and bankruptcy are the two terms that are the two options that live under the insolvency umbrella. Can you briefly define them each?
Okay. So with bankruptcy, we kind of think of this being the last resort. It's where you assign your assets to the licensed insolvency trustee for the benefit of your creditors. And in turn, you get a discharge from your unsecured debts. In a proposal, you're simply making an offer to settle with your creditors rather than doing the more formal bankruptcy. And it allows you basically to consolidate your debt into one payment and often at a significantly reduced amount. So for example, 30% of your debt in some cases maybe a little more or a little less. It varies from situation to situation.
What determines what that percentage is? Because I mean, hey, a lot of people would say, I would really like the 20% of my debt option. They're less happy with the 40% of their debt option.
For sure. So what we have to look at first is what would your creditors get if you did choose bankruptcy? So we have to look at your income. We have to look at your assets and determine what number is it that they would get in a bankruptcy. And then in a proposal, we have to base the offer on that. So if you have no assets and just straight salaried income, we're going to come up with you know, probably a 30% return, something like that. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a large amount of assets that would be available to your creditors in a bankruptcy, in order to keep those assets, you're going to have to offer something higher.
Hmm. Consumer proposals, when you look at the number, they have been growing much faster than bankruptcy filings over the course of the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years or so. Why is that?
I think people just appreciate that option better than a bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is a scary word to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And a proposal, they're paying something back to their creditors rather than just letting it all go. So I think from a moral standpoint for a lot of people, it makes better sense to them. And it's also a simpler process. They simply have one monthly payment to deal with. They need to do 2 credit counseling sessions. And that's it, you know, once we get past that approval point.
Right. So let's talk about the process. They pick up the phone, they call a licensed insolvency trustee. There is a conversation in which that trustee looks at their basic financials. What happens next?
Okay. So, you know, there's information we need to gather. Once we have all that information on their assets, their income, and other pertinent details, then we come up with a recommended amount that they should offer. And if they say, yep, let's go ahead. And of course, at that time, we're going to look at all options, not just proposal. But let's say we're going to go ahead with that proposal option. Then we prepare the legal documents. We get them signed. The offer gets sent out to the creditors. They get a 45-day period in which to receive, review, and vote on the proposal. Now, it's important to note that during this 45 days, they have protection from their creditors. No interest is charged. They can't sue, continue collections. Everything stops. And then in order to have that approval, we need a majority in dollar value voting in favor. So we do keep stats at our firm, and we find about 80% of our proposals are accepted as is the first time around. About 20% are accepted after we do some negotiations. So, you know, once it's been approved, it becomes a legally binding contract. And our role as the licensed insolvency trustee is to administer this program, to deal with your creditors, and to provide that financial counseling.
It is a federally regulated process through the Office of the Superintendent of Bankruptcy. There are standards, there are things. What should clients know about the fees involved? LITs are for-profit companies, like an estate lawyer or an accountant. Like, kind of what you do, it's how you pay your mortgage. How do you earn your fees?
Okay, so on every file with every trustee across Canada, we have this lovely thing called a tariff. And it's set out in the Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act. And so we get a percentage based on what is offered. So, you know, there's other fees and expenses involved as well. Of course, the government gets a filing fee and a levy. They've got to pay for their offices. And then we get the first 1500 and 20% of, and every time we issue payment to your creditors, we get 20%, they get 80%.
The creditors get 80%.
Correct.
Got it. So to oversimplify, the total fee on a consumer proposal that is successful, it's completed successfully over those 4 years, is the fee kind of $3,000, something like that, $5,000. What's the number?
Yeah. In thereabouts.
Yeah. What would make the credit score impact come alive for people? So there are consequences to this plan. It will affect their credit score. What are the differences on a consumer proposal versus a bankruptcy filing in terms of the impact on credit score?
Okay, so let's start with bankruptcy. So a first-time bankrupt, it'll be on your record for 6 years from the date of discharge. The discharge would take place after 9 or 21 months. A second-time bankrupt, It's on for longer, 14 years, and it's either a 24 or 36 month process. Now, in a proposal, it's on for 6 years from the date of filing or 3 years from the date of completion, whichever is sooner. So you do have the opportunity to have it off, come off your record a lot quicker than a bankruptcy, especially if you're able to put lump sum payments on it. It's open-ended, so you can pay it off at any time.
Some people enter a consumer proposal with the best of intentions. They are clear on their cash flow and they can't make it work. A year in, they can't make
Sure.
those payments work. What happens then?
Okay, so pick up the phone and talk to your trustee is the first step. Now, if it's a temporary thing, they've been injured or ill, and it's just going to be a temporary slowdown of income, then perhaps we can look at amending the proposal and asking the creditors to take a lesser amount because there's been a change. And if it's a long-term thing and an amended proposal doesn't make sense, then they could switch to a bankruptcy at that point.
For many people, most people picking up the phone and calling a credit counselor, calling a trustee is a big deal. What
Yes.
is the single most important thing you would say to people who are just like they've got the phone in their hand, they can't bring themselves to dial? What would you say to them?
Just do it. I've had more comments of why didn't I call you sooner, than I can count. Because we're not mean, scary people. We're
I
here. We're not. We're
know
here.
you're not. It's just funny to me to think that people would think that
They
they're
think they're
mean, scary.
lectured or judged or made to feel bad. That's not our job. Our job is to give you information and to guide you through the process.
Shelley, thank you for your time today.
You're welcome. I really appreciate it.
Shelley Coley is a licensed insolvency trustee with Harrison Partners. She joined us from New Westminster, BC, to talk about the consumer proposal and bankruptcy. What's similar? What's different? Pick up the phone, as Shelley said. Just do it. Coming up later, a behavioral science course for financial advisors. Michelle Hilscher from BE Works will be here to tell us about it. But first, we're going to speak with Will Reyes and Kevin Kleiman from a company called Humi about the benefits of supporting employees to pursue their side hustles. Yeah, the CEO says it's a good idea. In addition to this radio show on SiriusXM, I am also the money columnist for CBC Radio. On Wednesday afternoons, I natter on everything related to personal finance, investing, saving, topics in the news. So tune into those as well on Wednesday afternoons.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
You've heard a lot of talk about side hustles. A lot of people are talking about side hustles, working on side hustles. Part of it is about the money, and part of it could be like a passion project, right? It's not going to make them much money, but they love to do it. And a lot of people are doing this in addition to a full-time job. And I think those who pursue it say it's good for them as an employee, but how does it work for the employer? We're going to get into that part of the story today. Will Reyes is a full-time marketing content lead at a company called Humi, which is a software company in broadly in the HR world. She has a side gig in photography, and her CEO is also with us. Kevin Kleiman is co-founder and CEO of Humi. They are both joining us from Toronto. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Will, let's start with you. Tell us about this side gig. Why did you start it, and what do you actually do?
Yeah, of course. So like you said, I'm really into photography. I've been in it
I've been into it for a really long time. So maybe like 10 plus years that I've just enjoyed doing it as a hobby. It's probably started from when I was like in high school, just really loved tapping into that creative side. And maybe about 5 years ago, I started to monetize it and use it as a side hustle. And that just came from some friends like realizing that I was kind of good at this hobby that I had. And they asked me to take some engagement photos for them. And then from there, just started to, by word of mouth, just started to get a couple clients, and it's turned into kind of like a side gig now.
In this completely artificial continuum of it's all about the money and it's all about the passion, where is the lever on that continuum for you when it comes to photography?
For me, I think it's more towards the passion side. Like I said, I was always into photography, so it was something I would be doing even if there was no money involved. Like I would have a camera and shoot wherever just because I love doing it. But I don't know. It's turned into this thing that I could gain a little bit of extra income from. And so I roll with it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And on this show, we talk about side hustles regularly. We talk about the gig economy. What was interesting to me about this conversation is, Kevin, your not only willingness, your endorsement of these side hustles. Why is that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think having a side hustle can be a very strong signal that the person is a lifelong learner. And for us, lifelong learners tend to be great contributors at our company.
How do you, what sort of policies or practices, either articulated or not, do you ensure have this work for your company?
Yeah, you know, I think it starts with a great communication and clear expectations around the role and what is expected from the company. Because if that person is producing what the company has required, then they're free to go build their side hustle, pursue other interests, you know, as long as the company is getting what it needs. It's really hard to quantify that in anyone with any one metric or set of metrics. So I really hesitate to veer outside this place where there's a high level of trust and very strong communication between, you know, that employee and the person they're reporting to.
Will has used up all of her vacation days. She has this dream gig to do this event that she's been asked to photograph on a day in which not only she doesn't have the day off, but there's a meeting. How do you talk this through with her?
Yeah, I mean, she should absolutely do that gig, assuming that that meeting isn't vital to the company, because in the long run, the trust that we're going to build with Will is going to be so much more valuable than a couple more hours of her working at her day job. Mm.
I don't want to be ageist, but I do think it's important that we layer in a bit of generational context here, because I'm a Gen Xer and the side hustle thing wasn't around in my early career. And I run an organization with lots of different people. What are some things, Kevin, you would say about how different generations think about side hustles and the rights they have to pursue that while also earning a full-time paycheck?
So I would call bullshit there. I don't think they think differently at all. I think that the different generations have access to a different level of resourcing and education. You know, if you have an interest in anything today, you can pursue that thing to the depths of the earth through YouTube and online learning. If you want to start a like small business, it is so easy to spin something up wherein you have unlimited people to sell to. Things have changed. Those things were not possible when you and I grew up.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think if they were, we would have gone for them. More people would have gone for them. I think it's really just in access and state of the world thing.
And I'm someone who's always done something on the side. Some of it would fit fully in a side hustle. Some of it would just be like, I have a very extensive volunteer life. And there are trade-offs that need to be made in terms of the number of hours that you sleep, the number of emails you can possibly return in a day. As a business leader, for sure, there are times in which on balance, I feel like that side hustle is taking away from that employee's contribution at work. Have you felt that ever?
Yeah, at times. And this is where the trust is so important, to be able to have that conversation and reinvest. It happens. I think it would, it inevitably will. You can't accept that other people, you know, will be able to work on side hustles and this type of thing won't happen. I think that's part and parcel of having a culture that embraces people's, ability to go out and learn and try new things in tandem with their day-to-day job. Mm.
Will, how do you manage the balance this? How do you manage balancing this for yourself?
For me, it's just scheduling mostly. So I do Humi is remote first, so that kind of helps with it. If I need to get to anything urgent, being remote first kind of helps with that because I can get to that thing, juggle or go back and forth between like my side hustle and Humi just really quickly, like get to that urgent thing and then go right back to my what I'm doing for Humi. But aside from that, yeah, just like I said, scheduling, trying to fit all the things that I do for my side gigs, like on the weekends or after hours, and then focusing on Humi stuff during like the regular working hours for Humi.
Kevin, how do you think about performance? Because if they're rock stars, super easy. Like they can demonstrate, they can do this without without affecting their work. If they are not, do you get concerned, or how do you navigate a concern that the side hustle might be getting in the way?
I think this brings me back to the upfront expectations with respect to what the role is and what the outcome needs to be for the business. And if those things are clear and they're well matched with the employee's skill set, and it's going to be easier to understand where they are, like if they're dropping off relative to expectations. But if your expectations aren't like well tied to that person's abilities, irrespective of the side hustle, none of this is going to work.
Organizations are fascinating ecosystems, and there are, as like much as we'd like to say we avoid politics, organizations involve people. So how do you, Will, and maybe then Kevin second, navigate some of the stuff that might be in the unsaid? So Will, you come in, oh my God, I had the best weekend, I did this amazing thing, but I'm so exhausted. My weekend was so exhausting because I did this big thing. And one of your coworkers is like, I'm pretty exhausted after their weekend. I am rested and relaxed and ready to work because I don't have a side hustle.
Like Kevin has said, like trust is just the main thing there. Like even if I'm exhausted from having done a couple of things with my side gig on the weekend, like trusting that I'm still able to show up to work and do what I need to do at Humi is a big part of it. Just knowing that like what I do in my side gigs is something that I choose to do. It's not like I'm forced to do those things or they're for myself. And so if I'm a little bit tired on a Monday morning, it's all my choice, right? And at the end of the day, like the work that I do for Humi is separate from that. So
what do you think, Kevin, makes it work at Humi in a way that it'd be more complex at a company with 10,000 employees? What are some of the differences that would make this a more challenging thing to scale?
I think culture is very difficult to scale. You have to be very thoughtful about who you bring into the organization and how you treat them and how your expectations of how they treat other people. To your point, at 10,000 people, I don't know how that would scale. We're 150 right now.
Yeah.
It sounds like a daunting problem to me. I wish I could.
It would be hard. Let me ask you another question. And I know this is a hypothetical because you may not have run into it. Some side hustles, there is a role in which that person is engaging other people around them. So let's say your side hustle is to sell something or to book people into an event. And there can be something that's a little uncomfortable about someone wanting to do a product, a multi-level marketing product display, you know, demonstration in the cafeteria over lunch or whatever it is.
I got you.
How do those sorts of things work? Because it's so much easier if you've got a no side hustle policy, you know, like it's written down. So sorry, I know you want to bring in your candles or your vitamins or whatever it is, but we just don't do that here.
Yeah, I think you can flip it to have it be a huge benefit to the organization. So I think intentions matter quite a bit. If people are preying on people with some shitty product, yeah, absolutely. You don't allow that. But there are a lot of people with great intentions and interesting businesses that you want to put up in, you know, in front of the entire company and help promote. This is a great example of that internally for us. One of the women who's worked at our company for a number of years, her name is Karen. She has a business called Sweet Afternoon. She makes these really awesome and really interesting sweets. And anytime we do a gift for a customer, I strongly encourage that we use her business over an outside vendor. And I think treating people well visibly within the organization is one of these great things that helps set culture. And maybe this is one of the things that will help it scale. But yeah, like I think it comes back to who you are and what your expectations are for people and what the culture is. But yeah, I think that like embracing it is probably the strongest path forward.
Just briefly before we go, social media. Woo! Someone's pumping their side hustle on social media. They are also an ambassador of your company. How do you navigate that?
Follow and retweet and give it all the love you possibly can, assuming the product is, you know, well-intentioned and a good representation of your company.
Yeah. Very interesting. It's very interesting stuff. I love that we're having this conversation. And I know I flew a lot of hypothetical balloons or lobbed a bunch of hypothetical balloons your way. But what is inspiring about it is your value around leaning into the benefit of that side hustle. It's great. Thank you very much for the conversation. Will Reyes is a full-time marketing content lead at Humi. She also has a side gig in photography. Kevin Kleiman is co-founder and CEO of Humi, and he actually thinks that's kind of great. Really interesting stuff. All right, coming up on Moolala, calling all financial advisors, improving your relationship with your clients through behavioral science. Michelle Hilscher from BE Works takes us through a new course that they've developed. And to stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can sign up to our newsletter. So it includes links to what we're doing on CBC Radio and CityLine and BNN Bloomberg and all that stuff. You can sign up at moolala.ca. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free. I love talking about behavioral science when it comes to your money. It is just such fascinating stuff. So helpful to see how our brains work and work well, and also sometimes how they work to our detriment. Now, there is a whole group of people who engage with clients on the topic of money every single day. They're financial advisors. And so there's a real match to enabling those financial advisors to understand the way our brains work such that they can help their clients do more good stuff when it comes to their money. Today, we're going to talk about a new course that was developed for the financial advisors. Our guest is Michelle Hilscher. She is VP Strategy and a behavioral scientist at BE Works. Hello there.
Hello, so happy to be here and talk about how we think.
So you've been on this show before. We've talked about some of the principles of behavioral science and the surprising conclusions and insights from the data. Why did you decide to create this course targeted at advisors?
Absolutely. So we wanted to get really practical and really into the day-to-day moments where people are on the cusp of making decisions, right? And so we knew that advisors have this opportunity to actually influence the behaviors of their clients, and that what they were missing perhaps was an understanding of what drives decision making and behaviors.
And what are some examples of the things that you cover in the course and that you would love for financial advisors to become more masterful at?
Absolutely. So the course is structured as 6 modules. And what we do is we start off by talking about that question of how do people navigate money decisions? And then we go into really great detail about how people think about time, because so much of it's about, you know, stretching your time horizon. How do you help people to do that? How do you help your clients navigate risk? In particular, we're imagining those moments when the market is volatile and, you know, investors are going to behave a way that maybe they don't want to.
Sell everything right now.
Absolutely. That's exactly the emotion and the hot state we want advisors to be able to address before it happens. So those are some of the main themes. But more importantly, I think it's really giving advisors access to a toolkit so that in the moment when you're having these conversations or sending those emails, you know, that's when they're actually starting to use these insights about human psychology to help their clients.
I was having a conversation with some very senior leaders in a high net worth firm last week. And there was this kind of belief that because they were operating at the highest levels of the asset under management world, that some of these rules didn't apply because the people are so smart and they're so driven and they're so accomplished, and that we don't want to talk down to them by, you know, talking about our silly little brains and the sort of things that people who don't have enough money, the mistakes that they would make. I bet you would argue that behavioral science applies to all humans, regardless of whether they earn $10,000 a year or $10 million a year. Please tell me that I am right.
You are right. And I can elaborate on how I know that you are. So for one thing, definitely we all use shortcuts when we make decisions, and it doesn't matter what the consequences might be of a poor decision, you know, whether it's the wrong coffee size we buy in the morning or the investment risk we choose to take on. So universal across people, and you'll see these biases in investors, but also in advisors themselves. The other thing that's interesting is there's research on ultra high net worth clients, just like you've mentioned, that shows that maybe they are ones who are a little bit more isolated in some ways and not as comfortable having money conversations. So that means that they're a little bit alone on an island, right? Dealing with these biases or maybe not being even aware that they exist.
Hmm. Module 5 is about advice specifically.
Yes.
And you look at the reality that you can provide someone with advice. They may or may not follow through on that advice. What's the takeaway for the advisor community on how to, I mean, if it were me, I would just yell at people and force them to bend to my will. But I guess advisors can't really do that.
Oh, we're trying to move away from being paternalistic.
All right, fine.
So I would say it's about trying to get people to buy into decision processes, buy into the decisions that they make, and set up some type of guardrails for themselves in the future so that they are looking after themselves when they're in that hot state, knowing that it's going to happen and that it's going to be really difficult in the moment to stick with the intentions that they have. Mm. So those would be some of the sort of big takeaways, I suppose. And then you know, the course itself provides really tactical examples of how you might do something like that. Mm-hmm. Sorts of conversations.
Give me an example. Can you give me an example of a tactical?
Yeah. So I think another, like a good example of this would be related to that hot state decision making that takes place, right? And you can plan ahead for sure. But then when the market drops, all of a sudden, do it again for us, Bruce, that noise, that sound, that reaction. We know, right? People are going to have that knee-jerk, emotionally driven desire to sell. And yeah. So, you know, part of this is about pre-committing. Like there's a plan, there's a set of actions that I am going to take that maybe are not reacting in that way, but instead taking advantage of the fact that it's low and maybe I'm going to buy something else with the support of my advisor. So those would be some examples, I think, that could be helpful.
There is a module around risk. And I think at base, financial advisors talk about risk tolerance. Like, yes. You know, would you be able to sleep if the market dropped 10%?
Yes.
No, I wouldn't be able to sleep. Therefore, you shouldn't be in that particular investment. What that doesn't account for is the risk, the longevity risk of investing in a particular investment vehicle that will give you 2% return, yes, versus 5 or 6% return. The much more dramatic risk, not about how you feel in a market downturn, but about the reality that you haven't saved sufficient funds. How do you talk about that? Because I think that is quite different for how a lot of advisors have been trained to talk about it.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's a very difficult conversation to have because people have such a difficulty time traveling and imagining what's going to happen in the future, have convinced themselves that they're going to be maybe happy with less and maybe willing to compromise on things in the future that they certainly will not compromise on right now. So I think that there's definitely research on the future self. You're probably aware of it. That could lead to different experiences, maybe during onboarding or maybe as a way of kind of recalibrating clients across time. For example, having them write a letter to their future self and really, you know, connect with that person. So I think that's definitely part of it. And then also understanding that it's all about risk composure, right? So you can ask people in many different ways how comfortable they will be with risk in the future. But if you could actually connect it to the behaviors that they demonstrate when there are changes that happen, you know, you actually go through that experience of time travel and see what happens. It's a nice way of connecting back to that original prediction people made. Because we know that it's very hard to know how you'll feel in the future and what you'll do. So better to use behavior as your guide.
Yeah. I had dinner last week with a 23-year-old.
And
she's a delight, super smart, amazing, amazing, amazing. And we engaged as friends. There's no familial relationship. It's not my child or anything. And I was reflecting on how completely different a human I am today than I was at 23. That's 30 years ago. In 30 years, I predict that I will be a completely different person than I am today. But who knows how? It's a very difficult, I mean, I can envision what I will look like, physically still handsome, just with less hair, but how I will feel and think and what my values will be, I don't know.
Yes. Yes. And I think that you're right on the mark there. I think that part of the challenge here is helping clients or investors understand that they need to change over time to match up with the fact that their needs will change. I know that oftentimes people just buy into, you know, the solution, the strategy, the decision that they have made, and they are content with it. They don't want to change it. It's a status quo bias. It's also this satisficing, right? Like, I put time and effort in, so I don't really want to have to reevaluate this in a year's time. But I think it's very important for financial advisors to set up the expectation that this is a journey and that you really do need to come back and reevaluate decisions as your life changes, and that there could be more than one, you know, option for you. It's maybe just that you start here and you're kind of graduating, if you will, to something else over time.
Any advice, pun intended, on how an advisor could integrate this thinking in their client relationship in a way that builds trust rather than is confrontational? Because what I know a yeah, but is for some advisors is, whoa, I don't want to go there because I can see with my eyes the biases that are impeding my client from doing what's right for them, but I'm earning a 1% fee on a $5 million AUM or like a portfolio, I don't want to say anything that's going to rock the boat, even if it is in their best interest.
Yes. Well, that's where I think it's partly helpful to have more than one channel with which to communicate with your client. So for example, one of the big issues is that often we're very overconfident. We think we know a lot, and an advisor might feel a bit uncomfortable, as you say, you know, kind of letting on that they see some gaps, they see some areas that need attention. So that's where it's possible that advisors could create an experience that a client goes through on their own, and they're able to discover for themselves that there are some places where don't know as much as what they think they do. It's a bit of an anonymous experience. They're not, you know, showing that they don't understand things to the advisor, come to that realization on their own, and then are in a better position to actually ask for help, or, you know, some guidance perhaps. It's kind of that, you know, that the example of draw a bicycle and explain the underlying mechanics. And you might describe yourself as someone who definitely understands bikes, is like a big cycling person. But when you go through that process, you see the illusion that you have that you've got explanatory depth on this issue. So I think, you know, something like that perhaps would help to reveal to the client where the value of the advisor actually comes in.
That's great. Where can people find out more about the course?
Oh, the course is available on the Canadian Securities Institute website. So you can actually go on there and check out the different modules, and you can actually sign up right online if you like. It's a self-paced course, so you don't have to do it all in one weekend. You can take a bit of time if you like. Yeah.
Breathe and practice. Michelle, thank you so much for this.
Oh, my pleasure. Always, always nice to speak with you.
Michelle Hilscher, VP Strategy and a Behavioral Scientist at BE Works. And she joined us to talk about a course that they have created that focuses on financial advisors and endeavors to give them some of the tools and context of behavioral finance. That's it for our show today. Thank you to our sponsor, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. If you have questions, comments, feedback, ideas, whatever it is, that's the best email. ask@moolala.ca. Subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to them. On social media, I'm at Bruce Selry on X, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.